Chapter 16. The Moorsums did manage to catch the homeward mail boat all right, but had only 24 hours in town. Thus the sentimental Willie could not see very much of them. This did not prevent him afterwards from relating at great length, with manly tears in his eyes, how poor Miss Moorsum the fashionable and clever beauty found her betrothed in Malata, only to see him die in her arms. Most people were deeply touched by the sad story. It was the talk of a good many days. But the all-knowing editor, Renouard's only friend and crony, wanted to know more than the rest of the world. From professional incontinence, perhaps, he thirsted for a full cup of harrowing detail. And when he noticed Renouard's schooner lying in port day after day, he sought the sailing master to learn the reason. The man told him that such were his instructions. He had been ordered to lie there a month before returning to Malata, and the month was nearly up. "We'll ask you to give me a passage," said the editor. He landed in the morning at the bottom of the garden and found peace, stillness, sunshine raining everywhere, the doors and windows of the bungalow standing wide open, no sight of a human being anywhere, the plants growing rank and tall on the deserted fields. For hours the editor and the schooner's crew, excited by the mystery, roamed over the island shouting Renouard's name, and at last, set themselves in grim silence to explore systematically the uncleared bush and the deeper ravines in search of his corpse. What had happened? Had he been murdered by the boys? Or had he simply, capricious and secretive, abandoned his plantation taking the people with him? It was impossible to tell what had happened. At last, towards the decline of the day, the editor and the sailing master discovered a track of sandals crossing a strip of sandy beach on the north shore of the bay. Following this track fearfully, they passed round the spur of the headland, and there on the large stone found the sandals, Renouard's white jacket, and the Malay sarong of checkered pattern which the planter of Malata was well known to wear when going to bathe. These things made a little heap, and the sailor remarked, after gazing at it in silence, "Birds have been hovering over this for many a day." "He's gone bathing and got drowned," cried the editor in dismay. "I doubt it, sir. If he had been drowned anywhere within a mile from the shore, the body would have been washed out on the reefs. And our boats have found nothing so far." Nothing was ever found, and Renouard's disappearance remained in the main inexplicable. For to whom could it have occurred that a man would set out calmly to swim beyond the confines of life with a steady stroke his eyes fixed on a star? Next evening, from the receding schooner, the editor looked back for the last time at the deserted island. A black cloud hung listlessly over the high rock on the middle hill, and under the mysterious silence of that shadow Malata lay mournful, with an air of anguish in the wild sunset, as if remembering the heart that was broken there. December 1913. The partner, and that be hanged for a silly yarn. The boatmen here in Westport have been telling this lie to the summer visitors for years. The sort that gets taken out for a row at a shilling a head, and asks foolish questions must be told something to pass the time away. Do you know anything more silly than being pulled in a boat along a beach? It's like drinking weak lemonade when you aren't thirsty. I don't know why they do it. They don't even get sick. A forgotten glass of beer stood at his elbow. The locality was a small respectable smoking room of a small respectable hotel, and a taste for forming chance acquaintances accounts for my sitting up late with him. His great, flat, furrowed cheeks were shaven. A thick, square wisp of white hairs hung from his chin. Its waggling gave additional point to his deep utterance, and his general contempt for mankind with its activities and moralities was expressed in the rakish set of his big soft hat of black felt with a large rim, which he kept always on his head. His appearance was that of an old adventurer, retired after many unholy experiences in the darkest parts of the earth, but I had every reason to believe that he had never been outside England. From a casual remark somebody dropped, I gathered that in his early days he must have been somehow connected with shipping, with ships and docks. Of individuality he had plenty, and it was this which attracted my attention at first. But he was not easy to classify, and before the end of the week I gave him up with a vague definition, an imposing old ruffian. One rainy afternoon, oppressed by infinite boredom, I went into the smoking room. He was sitting there in absolute immobility, which was really fakir-like and impressive. I began to wonder what could be the associations of that sort of man, his IU, his private connections, his views, his morality, his friends, and even his wife, when to my surprise he opened a conversation in a deep, muttering voice. I must say that, since he had learned from somebody that I was a writer of stories, he had been acknowledging my existence by means of some vague growls in the morning. He was essentially a taciturn man. There was an effect of rudeness in his fragmentary sentences. It was some time before I discovered that what he would be at was the process by which stories for periodicals were produced. What could one say to a fellow like that? But I was bored to death, the weather continued impossible, and I resolved to be amiable. And so you make these tales up on your own. How do they ever come into your head? He rumbled. I explained that one generally got a hint for a tale. What sort of hint? Well, for instance, I said, I got myself rowed out to the rocks the other day. My boatman told me of the wreck on these rocks nearly 20 years ago. That could be used as a hint for a mainly descriptive bit of story with some such title, as in the channel, apostrophe for instance. It was then that he flew out at the boatmen, and the summer visitors who listened to their tales. Without moving a muscle of his face he emitted a powerful odd, from somewhere out of the depths of his chest, and went on in his hoarse, fragmentary mumble. Tear at the silly rocks, not their silly heads, the visitors. I presume, what do they think, a man is blown out paper bag, or what, go off pop like that, when he's hit damn silly arm hint indeed. A lie? You must imagine this statuesque ruffian antelope in the black rim of his hat, letting all this out as an old dog growls sometimes, with his head up and staring away eyes. Indeed, I exclaimed. But even if untrue it is a hint, enabling me to see these rocks, this gale they speak of, the heavy seas, etc., etc., in relation to mankind. The struggle against natural forces and the effect of the issue on at least one, say, exalted, he interrupted me by an aggressive, would truth be any good to you? I shouldn't like to say, I answered, cautiously. T said that truth is stranger than fiction. Who says that, he mouthed. Oh, nobody in particular. I turned to the window, for the contemptuous beggar was oppressive to look at, with his immovable arm on the table. I suppose my unceremonious manner provoked him to a comparatively long speech. Did you ever see such a silly lot of rocks? Like plums in a slice of cold pudding. I was looking at them an acre or more of black dots scattered on the steel-gray shades of the level sea, under the uniform gossamer gray mist with a formless brighter patch in one place the veiled whiteness of the cliff coming through, like a diffused, mysterious radiance. It was a delicate and wonderful picture, something expressive, suggestive, and desolate, a symphony in gray and black, a whistler. But the next thing said by the voice behind me made me turn round. It growled out contempt for all associated notions of roaring seas with concise energy, then went on, I know such foolishness, looking at the rocks out there more likely call to mind an office I used to look in sometimes, at one time office in London, one of them small streets behind Cannon Street Station. He was very deliberate, not jerky, only fragmentary. At times profane. That's a rather remote connection, I observed, approaching him. Connection? To Hades with your connections. It was an accident. Still, I said, an accident has its backward and forward connections, which, if they could be set forth, without moving he seemed to lend an attentive ear. I. Set forth. That's perhaps what you could do. Couldn't you now? There's no sea life in this connection. But you can put it in out of your head if you like.
Yes, I could, if necessary, I said.
Sometimes it pays to put in a lot out of one's head, and sometimes it doesn't. I mean that the story isn't worth it.
Everything's in that.
It amused me to talk to him like this. He reflected audibly that he guessed story writers were out after money like the rest of the world, which had to live by its wits. And that it was extraordinary how far people who were out after money would go. Some of them. Then he made a sally against sea life. Silly sort of life, he called it. No opportunities, no experience, no variety, nothing. Some fine men came out of it, he admitted, but no more chance in the world, if put to it, than fly.
Kids.
So Captain Harry Dunbar. Good sailor. Great name as a skipper. Big man. Short side whiskers going gray, fine face, loud voice. A good fellow, but no more up to people's tricks than a baby. That's the captain of the Sagamore you're talking about, I said, confidently. After a low, scornful of course he seemed now, to hold on the wall with his fixed stare the vision of that city office, at the back of Cannon Street Station, while he growled and mouthed a fragmentary description, jerking his chin up now and then, as if angry. It was, according to his account, a modest place of business, not shady in any sense, but out of the way, in a small street now rebuilt from end to end. Even doors from the Cheshire Cat public house under the railway bridge. I used to take my lunch there, when my business called me to the city. Cleet would come in, to have his chop and make the girl laugh. No need to talk much either, for that. Nothing but the way he would twinkle his spectacles on you, and give a twitch of his thick mouth, was enough to start you off before he began one of his little tales. Funny fellow, Cleet. C-L-O-E-T-E Cleet. What was he a Dutchman? I asked, not seeing in the least what all this had to do with the Westport boatmen, and the Westport summer visitors and this extraordinary old fellow's irritable view of them as liars and fools. Evil knows, he grunted, his eyes on the wall, as if not to miss a single movement of a cinematograph picture. Poke nothing but English, anyway. First I saw him comes off a ship in dock from the States Passenger. Asks me for a small hotel nearby. Wanted to be quiet, and have a look round for a few days. I took him to a place friend of mine. Next time in the city, hello. You're very obliging, have a drink. Talks plenty about himself. Been years in the States. All sorts of business all over the place. With some patent medicine people too. Travels. Writes advertisements and all that. Tells me funny stories. Tall, loose-limbed fellow. Black hair up on end, like a brush. Long face, long legs, long arms. Twinkle in his specs. Jocular way of speaking in a low voice. See that? I nodded, but he was not looking at me. Never laughed so much in my life. The beggar would make you laugh telling you how he skinned his own father. He was up to that too. A man who's been in the patent medicine trade will be up to anything from pitch and toss to willful murder. And that's a bit of hard truth for you. Don't mind what they do think they can carry off anything and talk themselves out of anything. All the world's a fool to them. Businessman too, Cleet. Came over with a few £100. Looking for something to do in a quiet way. Nothing like the old country, after all, says he. And so we part I with more drinks, in me than I was used to. After a time, perhaps 6 months or so, I run up against him again in Mr. George Dunbar's office. Yes, that office. It wasn't often that I... However, there was a bit of his cargo in a ship in dock that I wanted to ask Mr. George about. And comes Cleet out of the room at the back with some papers in his hand. Partner, you understand? Aha, I said. He few £100. And that tongue of his, he growled. Aunt forget that tongue. Some of his tales must have opened George Dunbar's eyes a bit as to what business means. A plausible fellow, I suggested. H apostrophe M. You must have it in your own way, of course.
Well, partner, George Dunbar puts his top hat on and tells me to wait a moment. George always looked as though he were making a few thousands a year a city swell. Come along, old man. And he and Captain Harry go out to gather some business with a solicitor around the corner. Captain Harry, when he was in England, used to turn up in his brother's office regularly about 12. Sat in the corner like a good boy, reading the paper and smoking his pipe. So they go out. Model brothers, says Cleet to lovebirds, I am looking after the tinned fruit side of this cozy little show. Gives me that sort of talk. Then by and by, what sort of old thing is that Sagamore? Finest ship out, eh? I dare say all ships are fine to you. You live by them. I tell you what, I would just as soon put my money into an old stocking. Sooner. He drew a breath, and I noticed his hand, lying loosely on the table, close slowly into a fist. And that immovable man, it was startling, ominous, like the famed nod of the commander. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.